And at any given time, we have about 2,000 calories worth of glucose stored in our body, just like stored, easily accessible in times of need when we like need a short energy boost. And that's stored primarily in the liver and the muscle and the blood. But we have like hundreds and hundreds of hours, like 20,000 calories worth of energy of fat stored in the body, even in a lean person. So you want to be in a situation where you can bounce back and forth based on different energetic availability between burning glucose for energy or burning fat for energy. But to burn fat for energy, you have to be in a low insulin state.
This is episode 125 of the Neuro Experience podcast. I'm Louisa. I'm your host. If you're listening to this, then you probably already know that the two things I am deeply, deeply passionate about are one, neuroscience, and two, how to live a healthier life. Now, I've spent the last 10 years dedicating myself to the brain and devoting my life's best work to uncovering its mysteries. I have a complete fascination and obsession with this topic. I practice it professionally and love doing this podcast and giving you all the best insights and information possible. With that being said, if you see value in this podcast, please go over and leave a review in Apple iTunes and leave a star rating. I know that this is frustrating to stop the podcast, but hey, it'll probably take less than a minute to do. It helps get more information out to people on a global scale. Thank you so much for that. Now moving on to the episode. My guest this week is Dr. Casey Means, a medical doctor who completed her medical degree and training at Stanford School of Medicine and subsequently trained to be a head and neck surgeon before transitioning to functional medicine. Her training with the Institute for Functional Medicine allows her to help you stay healthy and heal from within. She's spent thousands of hours in the operating room and in the hospital and has seen almost everything that can go wrong in personal health. I think you're all going to really like this episode today because we dive deep into metabolic health. We go into blood glucose, insulin, and of course, neurology. We focus a lot on hyperinsulinemia, metabolic dysfunction, and genetics, but we also go in and talk a lot about the software that we now have available to us to track and monitor your blood glucose in real time. So I guess this podcast is great for anyone who is being introduced to the whole, you know, monitoring your blood glucose and anybody who really wants to understand how they can live a longer and healthier life by stabilizing their blood glucose levels. I would say that one of the things in this episode that fascinated me and really caught me by surprise was how important fluctuations in blood glucose are and why getting them under control can really have a positive effect on not just your metabolic health, but also the health of your brain with respect to stress and cortisol. So without further delay, here is Dr. Casey Means. Neuroscience, neurology, longevity, and beyond. Learn everything you need to know from the best physicians and experts in the world. The Neuro Experience podcast is a platform to help you understand what the brain is and how it shapes every part of our lives. Every episode comes to you from highly credible sources. I'm Louisa Nicola, medical neuroscientist from Australia living in New York City. Come and take a Neuro Experience with me. Dr. Casey, welcome to the Neuro Experience podcast. I've got to tell you, I've been waiting a very long time, and so have a lot of people, to hear you and hear all of your amazing insights. So welcome.
I'm so excited to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
You've got a really interesting story. Before we get into anything, tell me, how does a medical doctor who trained as a head and neck surgeon then just kind of transition into functional medicine? How does that happen?
Well, yeah, it was quite a journey. So it actually started kind of well before I went into surgery. When I first came to medicine as like a college student, you know, when I was pre-med, I was at Stanford when the Human Genome Project was wrapping up and all this direct-to-consumer genetic testing, these companies were starting to come online like 23andMe. And so it was a really exciting time in the Bay Area because the ecosystem was really all about personalized health and medicine. And what was so empowering to me was this idea that essentially we are this genetic blueprint, but the difference between health and disease is really how that genetic blueprint is expressed. And one of the biggest, or two of the biggest levers in how that happens is diet and lifestyle. So there's so much actionability in terms of personalized genetics. So that was sort of how I came to the biomedical sciences and sort of the mindset I was in when I started my, you know, entry into the medical field. And then flash forward, I went to medical school, and medical school was a bit, and it was also at Stanford, but it was a bit of a different environment there. Conventional medicine, modern medicine is sort of much more about pattern recognition, I would say. It's like you go in and you talk to a patient and you collect a detailed history and you do an exam and you do lab work and imaging, and together that creates this collection of signs and symptoms. Symptoms being subjective things that you've discovered about the patient, signs being objective factors. And when those sort of symptoms and signs all match up, you label it with a diagnosis. And then you can turn around and say, okay, I've got this diagnosis. What are the drugs and what are the, you know, invasive interventions that we can potentially, you know, slap on to quote unquote treat this, you know, disease. And so it was much more kind of algorithmic and kind of reactionary and a bit different from that sort of personalized approach that had been so much a part of my studies early on with genetics and nutrigenomics and whatnot. And I'd worked at 23andMe, and it was just a little bit of a different vibe. And so, you know, flash forward, I trained to become a head and neck surgeon, and and about 5 years into my career doing, and head and neck surgery is essentially the surgical treatment of conditions of the ear, nose, and throat. So colloquially known as ENT or otolaryngology. And what I was noticing is that so many of the conditions that I was treating were fundamentally inflammatory in nature. So treating a lot of sinusitis, which is inflammation of the sinuses. When your nasal tissue gets inflamed, you get blockages, pus builds up, you go in with surgery and you know, bust a hole in the sinuses and drain the pus out. Or you give, you know, steroids to shrink the tissue and let the pus drain out itself. Similar is true with like chronic ear disease and chronic ear infections, you know, with kids, which kids get all the time. It's a very similar process. The tissue that connects the ear to the nose, the ear normally drains into the nose through the Nissation tube. And when that tissue gets blocked up, you get pus in the middle ear, you know, either give antibiotics or you bust a hole in the eardrum and you drain the pus out. Same thing with like vocal cord granulomas, overuse of the vocal cords. You know, you might get an inflammatory mass building up on the vocal cord called a vocal cord granuloma, and you pluck it out with surgery. So it's a lot of these inflammatory disorders that you're treating with surgical interventions. And over time, this started to make less and less sense to me, because it's kind of like attacking a problem with the wrong tool. Like if these are fundamentally disorders of the immune system, and you have to step back and think, like, what is inflammation really? Inflammation is the body thinking that there is some threat, some foreign invader or something it has to fight, and then mounting an immune response with your immune cells, which often is accompanied by, you know, swelling and tissue inflammation and things like that. And so that's like fundamentally an immune problem. And surgery doesn't really do anything to address that. So I got really focused on how can we be thinking more deeply about inflammation and helping our patients avoid this chronic inflammation that's so tied in with so many of these ENT conditions. And then concurrently, you know, we're seeing how inflammation is associated with so many of the other chronic diseases that we're seeing in our country. It's associated with obesity and diabetes and Alzheimer's, dementia, inflammation in the brain, you know, and a lot of other chronic diseases. So clearly there's something going on there. And that really led to a journey to trying to understand the root causes of inflammation. And a lot of those trace right back to our diet and lifestyle and these exposures that we are, you know, that our bodies are witnessing in this day and age that we never really experienced earlier on in life. You know, we've got all this new sort of ultra processed food, refined grains, refined sugars that look very different from foods we ever were, you know, evolved to eat. We've got environmental chemicals and toxins that our bodies aren't used to. We've got chronic low grade stressors given our sort of daily modern lives and our digital world. We've got reduced sleep. We're sleeping quite a bit less than we used to 100 years ago. And then, you know, we're much more sedentary than we ever were. So all of these things translate in our body into sort of confusion and threat and can generate inflammation. And are big contributors to chronic disease, both the big ones you hear about all the time that are just like plaguing a huge percentage of our country, like obesity and diabetes, but also, you know, ENT conditions and some of these more niche things that you might not associate with it. So a big fact. So ultimately this really led me to kind of saying, hey, I don't know if my place is really to be in the operating room reacting to these diseases. I would much rather put my brain power and my energy into really understanding the molecular biology of why people are developing this inflammation and seeing if we can impact so much earlier and keep them out of the operating room. Surgery is expensive. It's morbid. It's not fun. And so anything we can do to really create, environments where people's bodies are a little bit less in threat mode is where I want to put my energy. So that led me to functional medicine, which really looks at the root causes of diseases. And also with really a big shift and focus towards network and systems biology, which I would say are very overlapped with functional medicine. And these are sort of modern areas of the biosciences where instead of looking at diseases as these sort of like isolated silos of sort of, if you look at symptoms of diseases, it's very easy to think they all look very, very different. But if you actually look at like the root cause pathophysiology of what's happening in a lot of different diseases, it's often very similar core pathways like inflammation. And another huge one is metabolic dysfunction and insulin resistance. If you look at some of the most common diseases today, diseases of the brain, diseases of, you know, obesity, diabetes, heart disease, stroke, hypertension, a lot of these are rooted in insulin resistance. And so really functional medicine focuses on how do we impact those core physiologic processes that underlie seemingly disparate diseases. And if you can impact those links between diseases, which is essentially thinking of diseases as networks as opposed to isolated silos, you move from playing whack-a-mole in medicine and just like reacting to each disease individually to a much more efficient practice where you're actually impacting one core pathway could have really massive multifarious effects. So that was really a wonderful transition. And I, you know, was able to work on patients on anti-inflammatory lifestyles, on really getting their blood sugar and their metabolic health under control, and sort of see a lot of symptoms from all different parts of their bodies just kind of melt away because we were attacking the root cause. And so a lot of that ultimately came down to, and this was a full shift out of the OR. I left the operating room. I started a functional medicine boutique private practice focused on longevity and metabolic health. And what it came down to, though, I was like now a year into that practice and thinking, you know, For patients to do well and for the patients who have been really successful, the key factor has been that they've changed dietary and lifestyle factors. They've essentially changed behaviors that affect these core physiologic pathways, create conditions in the body that change cellular biology. So really this comes down to how do we get people to change their behaviors in a way that's personalized and sustainable and affects root cause physiology. So that behavior change piece became key. And the reality is I can't be with my patients 24 hours a day telling them exactly what to do and what's best and what's not best. So that's where digital tools and digital health can be profound because people's devices are with them 24 hours a day and can give feedback. And so, started consulting quite a bit to digital health companies that were trying to use behavior change modalities to essentially reverse, you know, our chronic disease epidemics. And that's what I do now. I'm a functional medicine physician. I work with a company that creates a digital health tool to help people reverse metabolic disease, and that's sort of the two things that I split my time between now. So that's kind of the journey.
I love it. It's, you know, what's really fascinating, just listening to you talk, I've noticed a trend, and this is amongst a lot of my friends, especially the ones who have come on the podcast. I was just doing one with Dr. Asim Malhotra. He's a ex-cardiothoracic surgeon. Now he is a cardiologist consultant, but he's also now he's just brought out a book. I think it came out about a week ago, and it's all about metabolic dysfunction. And as we were talking before we got on the podcast, My good friends and colleagues over at Wild Health in Kentucky are focused 100% on precision medicine, and they're all MDs. And they thought, you know what, we're going to get out of the OR and we're going to focus and bring about this change in medicine, which I really believe that this is the future. I think that personalized medicine is fantastic. It's something that we didn't know of 10 years ago, but now we can actually assess somebody's, you know, from genotype, phenotype, really understand what's going on from a molecular level, what's going going on in their body and how can we then fix it? Because what's going on with you and what's going on with me, there's not going to be a pill that's going to fix the both of us in the exact same way. So what you're doing in this, in terms of functional medicine, I think is absolutely phenomenal. Now, you mentioned a few things that I want to get into. The first one is, ding, 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 metabolic health, metabolic dysfunction. I think this is a really great topic to get into and introduce to the world. It's something that I've seen floating around over Instagram. And a lot of people are like, okay, metabolic health, what is that? My metabolism. We don't really know too much about it. We just know what we learned in school. I want to get into that because I do want to say also disclaimer, we know that this is a neuroscience podcast. I solely believe, and I'm focusing a lot now on talking to longevity experts like yourself on why, you know, how do we correct our metabolic function, because it does play a huge role in brain health. You know, I don't even need to go into Alzheimer's disease, concussion, for example. These are the two areas that I solely focus on, and my research is all based within those areas. But why don't you kick us off and introduce us to metabolic health and what is metabolic dysfunction?
Yes, sure. So I'll kind of start with what metabolism is, I think. So metabolism is basically the set of cellular mechanisms that generate energy from our food and environment. And we need to do this because we take in energy that is food, but we can't use it unless it's converted into cellular energy, which is typically thought of as something like ATP. So we have to take in energy from food and convert it in our bodies to a usable form of energy. And for every single cell in our body to work and function, we need to process and produce and excrete energy efficiently. And when that process is not going well, that is essentially metabolic dysfunction. And metabolic dysfunction can show up as virtually any symptom in any organ, because based on where that metabolic dysfunction and that poor energy production is happening, depending on what organ and cell type that it is happening, you will see different symptoms, which is why it has so many far-reaching effects, and also why it makes a really efficient area for us to focus on to get really wide-ranging improvements in health. So zoning in a little bit, so some of the primary substrates for energy in the body are glucose and fat. Glucose is kind of colloquially known as sugar, but it's a specific type of sugar. And when we take in carbohydrates, they can be broken down into glucose, and then that floats around in our bloodstream. And for us to be able to take that up into our cells and convert it to usable energy, it requires the body to secrete a hormone called insulin from the pancreas. And insulin floats around in the blood when glucose gets elevated, and it basically binds to cells and lets those cells take up glucose so that glucose can be processed in this tiny little part of the cell called the mitochondria and turned into ATP. So when you have glucose, and I will say that the body keeps glucose extremely tightly regulated in the body. If it's too high, it's a problem. And if it's too low, it's a problem. And you'll have symptoms from both of those things. And so when you eat glucose or foods containing quite a bit of carbohydrates, your glucose will elevate, and that causes that insulin release. And when that happens over and over and over again, and the more glucose or carbohydrates you eat, the higher those elevations are going to be and the higher the insulin surge is going to be. What happens is that the cells are seeing all of this insulin and they actually get numb to its effects. It's like, you've been around here too much. Like, we're going to kind of block the signal a little bit, and they get a little bit confused. And that's a process called insulin resistance. And then when that happens, your body and your cells still need to get that glucose in them. So they actually have to produce more insulin to get the same amount of glucose into the cells. So you start getting what's called hyperinsulinemia, which is essentially high insulin levels, because you've been spiking the glucose, you know, too frequently, and your cells have become numb to this insulin. What's interesting is that when that insulin gets elevated in the blood, insulin has actually independent effects on every single cell type in the body. So it has hundreds, if not more, functions. And to dive super into this, there's a really amazing book that was just published like a couple weeks ago by Dr. Ben Bickman, called Why We Get Sick, that talks all about the different effects of insulin on the body. But really, it's a pro-growth signal for almost any cell type. And so it promotes, you know, storage and growth. And that's why it's really tied in with diseases like obesity. But insulin also tells the body, it's a signal to the body saying, we've got a lot of glucose around. We don't need to use other forms of energy right now. So it actually blocks the breakdown of fat for energy. So if your insulin is high, you are not burning fat for fuel. And the situation that we want to be in is that when glucose is around, we can use glucose for energy. But when glucose is not around, we can tap into our fat stores for energy. And at any given time, we have about 2,000 calories worth of glucose stored in our body, just like stored, easily accessible in times of need when we like need a short energy boost. And that's stored primarily in the liver and the muscle and the blood. But we have like hundreds and hundreds of hours, like 20,000 calories worth of energy of fat stored in the body, even in a lean person. So you want to be in a situation where you can bounce back and forth based on different energetic availability between burning glucose for energy or burning fat for energy. But to burn fat for energy, you have to be in a low insulin state. So we've gotten ourselves in this tough situation where we have been exposed to just massive amounts of sugar and refined carbohydrates in our modern diets. It's one study I read said that we're eating about 150 pounds of refined sugar per year per person these days. And about 100 years ago, we were eating about 2 pounds per person. So it's just like astronomical levels. Our bodies have no idea what to do with all this sugar. And our insulin levels are just really high, higher than they should be. And you can imagine what that does is it when you run out of glucose, essentially, let's say you haven't eaten in a few hours or you did a big exercise or, you know, overnight, you might be so hungry. Your body's not tapping in to that. It's not able to just quickly switch over and tap into fat burning because your insulin's high. And that's called metabolic inflexibility. And that's a state we don't want to be in. We want to have, so to kind of to circle back, metabolic health is a state of metabolic flexibility where you've kept your glucose levels stable and not super spiky based on how you're eating and how you're living. So you have insulin sensitivity, your insulin levels aren't chronically high at baseline, and you are essentially able to flip-flop between burning fat and burning glucose for energy based on what substrates are available. So that's sort of the long story short, but happy to go into any more of that as well.
Well, back to insulinemia. Yeah. Do you see, like when you're looking at this, especially from a CGM perspective, do you see normal glucose levels but elevated postprandial insulin? Like, I mean, it's a tough situation because like you said at the start, it comes down to genotype. Everybody's different. So the way that, you know, you may ingest a spoonful of honey, it may elevate your glucose to a level that it may be completely different for me. Now, would that be indicative of like who is metabolically, you know, not fit in that area? Would it be you or me?
It's a great question. And so right now, the continuous trackers that we can use to measure metabolism is continuous glucose monitors. There's unfortunately no continuous insulin monitors available.
Unfortunately.
You can do some. Unfortunately, that would be the holy grail because it is thought that insulin levels are probably elevated probably around a decade before your glucose levels actually start to sort of chronically rise. So what we're testing to sort of assess metabolic health currently in our system is you go to the doctor once a year, you get a fasting blood glucose test. And if your fasting glucose is under 100 milligrams per deciliter of glucose, they say you're totally normal, you're totally fine. But it may be that you're in sort of the upper end of normal in your fasting glucose, but that your body's actually pumping out tons of insulin to keep it at that level. And that may have started, you know, years, if not decades, before your cells get so sort of fed up that eventually you can't shuttle enough glucose into the cells. And then you start getting that fasting glucose elevation that ultimately gets you maybe like a pre-diabetes or a diabetes diagnosis. But that insulin was elevated long, long before. So there's quite a movement in the longevity physician space to really start using fasting insulin as an early marker to start looking at people who are more at risk for metabolic dysfunction or who are showing early signs of metabolic dysfunction. And I think that would be very, very wise. I think your question was getting at sort of this individuality between how you respond to carbohydrates, which is super fascinating. There's really interesting research that came out about 5 years ago, published in the journal Cell by the Weissman Institute in Israel, that was called Personalized Nutrition by Prediction of Glycemic Responses. And what they showed is that you could feed a bunch of people standardized meals with the exact same carbohydrate composition, and everyone might have a completely different glucose elevation. You know, you and I could both eat a banana and I could go to like 170 milligrams per deciliter of glucose, a super high response, and you could go to like 95, a totally reasonable response. And so that banana is probably a better choice for you and not for me. And I think your question was more like, does that indicate something about metabolic health? And I think the answer is yes, yes and no. The answer is yes. But there's also other factors involved in that too. So what was predictive of the glucose response in that study? Some of the things that were important were like body type and anthropomorphic features, which can be indicative of insulin sensitivity. People who have more visceral adiposity, like around the middle, tend to be more insulin resistant. So that was one factor. But also microbiome had like a huge impact on predict, and they created a model based on stool samples and these other factors that could predict how a person would respond in terms of their glucose to that standardized meal. So a lot of exciting stuff coming down the pipeline, but the reality is that to know what to eat to have that stable low glucose that will ultimately generate regained insulin sensitivity, because I kind of think of it like working out and like reps. Like each day that you keep your glucose fairly low and stable, you're likely kind of regaining a little bit of insulin sensitivity because you've likely kept your insulin levels lower than they would have been otherwise if you were spiking. So it's kind of like going to the gym. It's building metabolic fitness. And so over time, as you get those reps in, you might see a different response. But in the short term, it's important to know which things spike you and which things don't, so you can choose the things that don't and essentially do that metabolic fitness, you know, workout essentially. So
No, that's incredibly important. I was referring in a earlier episode to a study that was literally just done. I think it was produced by The Lancet back in July. And what they did was they found that the glucose response to athletes who have taken a blow to the head from 24 hours to 24 hours after the hit and 7 days after that, they found an immediate correlation between dietary intake of fats and glucose and what was adding to the whole, you know, cytokine inflammatory response. And they're trying to reverse and mitigate these blows to the head and trying to really delay the onset of a concussive or a subconcussive hit by attacking their glucose. So that's why it's so important and so interesting to me that, especially when you look at neurologists, they don't have any other way of really learning about metabolism or metabolic dysfunction because you're just so into the neurology field. And I think that's where when we look at medicine, when people go in and they specialize, it's not doing them a disservice, but you just get so caught up in your own field that you don't look at other things that could be affecting certain neurological disorders. So that's where my love for longevity and functional medicine has come into play.
Oh yeah, I was just going to say that. It's super fascinating, and there's a strong link between, you know, inflammation, hyperglycemia, high blood sugar, and inflammation. And I haven't read that study, but I think it makes a lot of sense to me that tighter control of glucose in the post-concussion or post-TBI setting would have an impact. I'd read another study, it was a couple years ago, but it was like about doing high dose omega-3 supplementation, I think, after TBI for a similar sort of anti-inflammatory effect. And the diabetic state and hyperglycemia can promote TNF-alpha, one of the, you know, big inflammatory cytokine releases. And so I'd imagine that could be happening in the setting of an injury. And it's also interesting because when you look at, they've looked at mice with like depression, and mice who are diabetic have increased TNF-alpha in their brains, which seems to lead to decreased levels of serotonin. And so there's this really interesting link between, you know, sugar, inflammatory cytokines, and then ultimately like neurologic function and phenotype and outcomes. And so, yeah, it's really fascinating.
That whole world, especially like the psychiatric illnesses are not my forte, but I did read a recent study about the correlation between glutathione and schizophrenia, and I've become so fascinated. And like I said, I'm heading out with Ben Greenfield, and he was discussing, and I think he's going to make us all do it. He's taking these glutathione suppositories. Never taken a suppository, but you know, he's into that. I was like, that's really, really interesting. It's fascinating. You can take it through an IV as well, but all these different things that are adding up to brain health is and brain dysfunction really fascinate me. What I want to get into now is CGMs, continuous glucose monitors. Like, what are they, and what's your affiliation with Unlock Levels? Introduce us to the company.
Yes, sure. So, continuous glucose monitors are these incredible little devices. They're about the size of a quarter. You stick them on the back of your arm. They stay there for 14 days, and what they do is they measure your glucose in the background 24 hours a day for that entire 14 days that you're wearing them. And it takes a measurement every 15 minutes and then sends that information to your smartphone. So you can essentially track in real time how diet and lifestyle are affecting your metabolism. And they're incredible in that regard, and they're painless. And what they originally were intended for was, and what they're FDA approved for, is for management of type 1 and type 2 diabetes. And so this was really game changing when these came online, because formerly people with these conditions were having to prick their fingers with a needle, you know.
That's one, what I've been doing.
Yeah.
Like four or five times a day.
You get so used to it. Like, I've, you know, pricked my finger so much for ketones and glucose in the past. And, you know, over time it's fine, but it's not fun. And it's kind of a hassle. And you're just getting this like very ungranular data stream. You may totally miss the post-meal spike, which may only last for, you know, 5 or 10 minutes, and maybe catching it on the upswing or the downswing and not really have an understanding of what an actual, you know, glucose response to a meal was. So it provides just massively more granularity about that. And so, you know, I think a lot of people in the longevity and the metabolic health and the precision medicine space all are very, very focused on metabolic health and how important it is for really all aspects of health and wellness and prevention of really almost every chronic disease. And so the thought is like, well, how could we maybe leverage this incredible technology and use it in people before they have sort of overt disease and help people essentially shape their diet and lifestyle to keep their glucose as stable and flat as possible, to not only improve quality of life right now in your current living, because avoiding up and down spikes, even if you're otherwise, you know, normal and healthy, is hugely advantageous for just current day-to-day life, especially in regard to cognitive performance and mental health and energy and many other things related to, especially to brain health. But it also may help ward off these more long-term diseases that we see associated with metabolic dysfunction, like diabetes, obesity, heart disease, stroke, Alzheimer's, dementia, you know, fatty liver disease, chronic kidney disease, that all are directly related to, you know, long-term blood sugar dysregulation. So it's really about allowing people to close the loop for the first time between what they're eating and how it's affecting their metabolic health. And the beauty of it is that, you know, it just takes away, it does a few things. One, I think most people are very confused about nutrition. You know, no one knows whether they should be doing, you know, keto or paleo or vegan or, you know, ancestral diets and whatnot, carnivore. And it just pulls out the rug from under a lot of that debate and controversy and really puts the power back in the individual. You can just see in real time, like, oh, I ate this breakfast and it put me up into diabetic blood sugar levels. Like, I'm not going to choose this as a good option in the future. It just totally takes the mystery away and is very empowering in that regard. So yeah, it's interesting. Like, we've had, for all the other lifestyle things that we care about, you know, like stress management, sleep, exercise, we've had wearables that have helped us track this. Like, there's Oura Ring, there's Whoop, there's 8 Sleep, there's Apple Watch, there's Fitbit, but there's not been a single thing to close the loop on nutrition and how it's affecting our health in real time. So it's in a really exciting time to take this technology to the mainstream. And what I love is that, like, this basically gives people the power to say, like, I'm never going to walk into the doctor's office and have a huge surprise about my metabolic health. If you're tracking it, it's not like one day a light switch goes off and all of a sudden you have type 2 diabetes. This is something that's developing over years and years and years. So if you can keep your glucose stable and in a healthy range, you're in control. Like, there will be no surprises, and you know that you're at lower risk for all of the conditions associated with it. So I think that's a really beautiful, beautiful thing. It really puts the power in the hands of the individual. So Levels is a company that I'm a co-founder of, and we are creating software to overlay on top of this glucose data stream to make this data stream as highly actionable, insight-driven as possible, and use it essentially to create sustainable behavior changes and to inform choices that will keep people in that low and stable range. And so that's what we're doing. And we're in a closed beta program right now. We've had about 800 people go through our program and give us intensive feedback. And we've put out about 400 versions of our app, just refining it and you know, making sure it's as useful as possible to our customers. And we're planning for a full launch later this year.
Congratulations. It's absolutely phenomenal. I just want to know, when you're wearing the monitor itself, you mentioned 14 days, but to get a true average glucose for yourself, to really understand that, you'd have to wear it for about 90 days, right? And keep monitoring it over a 90-day period to really understand your true average blood glucose level.
Well, I think wearing it for longer is excellent, but I actually find that getting averages even for 24-hour periods can be incredibly interesting. So what I've found, I've been wearing it for about a year. And what I found is that, like, based on what's going on in my life and whether I'm traveling and how stressful things are and whether I'm really on point with all of my, you know, wellness practices, my daily 24-hour average glucose can bounce around by like 10 points. Like, I can be 75, which would be on the really good end for me for 24-hour average glucose, or I can be up in the mid to high 80s, just depending on whether I'm, you know, doing what I know it keeps me in my healthiest range. And so it's actually really fascinating to see how dynamic it is. And I think what it does is it just really solidifies this point that, like, what I'm doing and how I'm living, like, is the differentiating factor between the two different outcomes of a high average or a low average. And so it's very, very motivating. And I use it to basically keep me on track. Like, at this point, the insights I've learned from it, what I should be eating, how I should be pairing foods, when I should be eating foods, what exercises are best for my metabolic health, what stress management practices keep my glucose low, how, you know, sleep impacts it, et cetera. Like, all the factors that go into keeping glucose stable, of which they are those things that I mentioned. So, like, food timing, food combination, sleep, exercise, and stress management are the big ones. Those things have sort of been clarified. The first few months, I really feel like I nailed those in. And now it's much more about that accountability piece, like keeping me on track, keeping me on my healthy behaviors. And for that, I plan to wear it forever because it really is just like, it doesn't lie. It just tells me the truth every day of basically how things are going. It doesn't lie. And I love it because food marketing
does not lie.
And a lot of the loud voices in the nutrition space, like, they are compelling, they are loud, they have big budgets, and to have something that is able to just, like, essentially stand in the face of that and say, this is what's true for me, I think is extremely powerful.
So what determines a healthy range? So once you receive this monitor, who, you know, and I'm on the app, how do I know what's a healthy range for me?
Great question. So we've actually defined what we consider an optimal range to be between 70 and 110 milligrams per deciliter of blood glucose. So when people stay inside that fairly narrow range, that's considered optimal metabolic health. And those numbers are not numbers you're going to find in a normal medical textbook, because up until now, we have essentially been the only numbers we've been able to orient around are the numbers that we use to diagnose prediabetes, normal, or diabetes. And those numbers don't actually tell us what's optimal for really good metabolic health. So currently, if you go to the doctor and you get your finger pricked and they check your fasting glucose, you know, once a year during your yearly physical, if your fasting glucose is below 100 milligrams per deciliter, you're considered normal and healthy. And like we talked about before, that's not necessarily true. Someone's insulin could be through the roof to keep their blood glucose there, and they're just on the teeter-totter about to, like, topple into, like, full-blown, you know, prediabetes, and it's going to show up on that fasting glucose. So under 100 is a very lenient term and really actually means nothing without having the insulin on top of that. If you're between 100 and 125, you're considered pre-diabetic, and 126 or above, you're considered diabetic. And there's a couple other tests that they use to look at this. One is hemoglobin A1C, which is an average.
I was going to bring that up actually.
Yeah. So this is a blood test that looks at the amount of glycated hemoglobin in your body. And that basically is like on your red blood cells, you've got hemoglobin molecules. And if blood sugar is higher in the bloodstream, more sugar is going to actually literally stick to that hemoglobin. That's called glycation of hemoglobin. And you can measure how much of the hemoglobin is glycated or has sugar stuck to it. And blood cells last for about 90 days. So this, before they die and are repopulated. And so this test gives you an average 90-day glucose level, but it's not, and if it's between 5.7 and 6.4, you're considered pre-diabetic. 6.5 and above is diabetic, and below 5.7 is considered normal percentage. And it's, you know, it's again, not a really useful clinical test because one, people's red blood cells last for very different amounts of time. They can range from like 70 to 120 days. And so that can really impact the test. And also, again, it doesn't tell you about what level of insulin had to be present to keep that blood glucose at that level. And so, and then the third test is that they use to diagnose prediabetes or diabetes is the oral glucose tolerance test, where you pound like 75 grams of liquid glucose, this really yucky drink called Glucola, and then they measure your glucose 1 hour and 2 hours after the test. And if you are essentially below a level of 140 after 2 hours after drinking this huge glucose drink, you're considered quote unquote normal, which I think is egregious because to be that high ever if you're non-diabetic is totally problematic. And so what one of my first things that I did when we started Levels was I was like, we're going to double down on like, let's look at all the research about what is actually healthy glucose levels. And we're going to come up with the ranges that really fit with the research about what it means to be in the optimal glucose ranges. And so there's around, 6 or 7 large studies where they've put CGMs on healthy non-diabetic populations and just like tracked their glucose over time to get a sense of like, what is just a healthy person's glucose levels? Like, what is it normally on a 24-hour a day? That stuff like was never possible to do that type of study before CGMs were around. So thank goodness some research labs had the foresight to put these on non-diabetic people and actually get that data. And what that shows, and I'm going to kind of summarize it, but that for a person who is non-diabetic and otherwise healthy, they spend about 91% of the day between glucose ranges of 70 and 120. So only about 9% of the day below 70 or above 120. A couple other studies show that are more lenient about the population and have some bigger populations show that it's actually people spend about 90% of the day between 70 and 140. But the bottom line is people should probably like rarely, if ever, go above 140 if you're non-diabetic. And then another really interesting thing I learned in my really deep dive into this literature was some studies looking at people with normal fasting glucose levels. And this was a study published in the New England Journal of Medicine that looked at healthy men, healthy young men who had normal fasting glucose levels, so under 100. And they separated the people under 100 into quartiles from like the lowest to the highest quartile. So lowest was like 70 to 78 milligrams per deciliter, like 78 to 85, 85 to 92, 92 to 100, or something like that. But it was like 4 quartiles within normal. And the people at the lowest quartile versus that highest quartile of normal, the people at the highest quartile were much higher risk for the future development of metabolic disease. So even within normal, the higher you are, the more likely you're going to develop something like diabetes and all of the sequelae. And they did a very similar study for stroke outcomes, basically showing that before you even get to a fasting glucose of 100, if your fasting glucose is in the upper ranges, you have much higher risk of hemorrhagic and ischemic stroke. So to just be telling a patient, your blood glucose is 90, fasting glucose is 99, you're fine, that's wrong. Like, that is unequivocally false. So
the reason why I think, like, just to, sorry to interrupt, but I think it has a lot to do with the relationship between cortisol and whenever you're going to go and get a typical blood test, because I know that there's a strong relationship between cortisol and HDL and LDL levels, which is why I never say go and test your LDL levels especially after a woman is menstruating, for example, or when they've gone through a stressful, let's say a stressful breakup, a stressful period in their lives, I know that cortisol and stress really affects their LDL and HDL levels. Now, I know that insulin gets this big rap. Okay, I understand it gets a lot of attention, and I know that we can't continuously track cortisol in the blood. However, I think cortisol is a very underappreciated regulator of fat flux through the fat cell. So how can one wake up and say, well, just say they've gone to bed and they've had a stressful night. Okay, let's just say they've been up, they didn't have a really good sleep, they were not in, they had a crap sleep, they woke up, and then they're judging their whole blood glucose level on that day's fasting blood glucose level. Like, what's the relationship between cortisol, stress, and blood glucose?
Yeah, it's such a great question. And it's another reason why these one time point markers to assess people for disease are really kind of antiquated, because like you're saying, like it bounces around quite a bit based on circumstances like stress. So cortisol is really interesting in relation to glucose. Cortisol is our stress, you know, one of our primary stress hormones, and it's released when the body thinks we're in a time of stress. And what it does for glucose is really evolutionarily advantageous. If we think that something stressful is about to happen, and historically that would be a physical threat. So I'm going to go with the classic example of like you're getting chased by a lion. Your body sees a lion, it releases cortisol, and the body is then thinking, I have to run to escape this lion. And so what does that mean? It means your muscles will need glucose to function very efficiently. So what cortisol does is it tells the liver, dump out all your stored glucose into the bloodstream so that you can then feed the muscles with this quick acting energy source. So you will find that people who are dealing with physical stress, psychological stress, or just, you know, perceived stress, that you can see a glucose elevation. And I've seen that in myself. We've seen in a lot of our early customers. It's seen in the research literature. And so it's very interesting. It's like an evolutionary sort of advantage that now has kind of gone awry in our current lifestyles, which have a lot of low grade sort of chronic stressors that don't require us to need more glucose in our bloodstream, because they're not requiring us to do any physical activity. You know, it might just be like a stressful email or a stressful conversation with a colleague or something like that, or like even anticipation of a stressful event like anxiety. And these things can get your body through that cortisol signal to release glucose for essentially a reason that we don't need anymore. So you can imagine if you went to go get your fasting glucose checked at the doctor on a day that you'd had poor sleep, and also sleep deprivation significantly increases cortisol levels. If you went on one of those days, you would have, you know, essentially a measurement that wasn't necessarily accurate. And so more continuous testing, and even maybe using in the future CGMs for all sorts of diagnostic purposes, might be really helpful. And I think an interesting corollary to this is like, it's very difficult to diagnose like an arrhythmia, like a heart electrical conduction issue with a single EKG. An EKG like picks up 5 or 10 heartbeats, and you might just miss the atrial fibrillation or the A-flutter or whatever the arrhythmia is. So they send people home with these Zio patches or Holter monitors, which last for weeks or a month. And you need to have that on there to really pick up the trends of what's happening. And it's no different for something like metabolic health, which is also super dynamic and super in flux. So I think there's going to be emerging quite a bit of diagnostics moving towards more continuous metrics like this for all those reasons.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's incredibly important to really track your, like you said, like being able to track it in real time. I was looking at Dom's Instagram, Dom D'Agostino, and he posted something, I think it was around the 7th of August, and he posted what I used earlier, the analogy of this spoonful of honey. And he said, you know, I love the things that he puts up. He's like, I just had 2 dates and this is what it did. I had this peanut butter cookie. This is what it did. And it's really interesting to see how he's reacting to honey as opposed to somebody else, like I said. So everybody's different, which is why I think this whole process of precision medicine is coming into play. I want people to know, I want everybody, especially if you're listening to the podcast, to know that what I'm doing and what I'm putting out there on Instagram, like in terms of like how I sleep, is completely different to the way that you are going to measure your sleep. I think that's the one thing that we want to know with levels, right? Everybody's different. It's about tracking what affects you, what doesn't affect you, and being able to stay in that healthy range, which you said is between 70 to 110. So you can then become more metabolically fit. So you can have a healthier life, live longer, perform better, and just be, you know, fight off diseases. That's what we're looking at, right? If we really come down to a really basic level, to, you know, I'm it's like when my mother, I'm just trying to, you know, foresee the conversation of when I walk into my parents' house and they see this patch on me, so they don't think I'm terminally ill. I want to be able to tell them, this is what I'm doing, this is why I'm doing it, and this is going to be the end product of what I'm doing.
I think you described it so beautifully. Yeah, it's about, you know, it is really removed from the concept of illness, which we think of as really, I think, an on and off switch. This is about this is about informing choices that will ultimately create conditions in the body that generate the expression of health through optimized cellular biology. Like, this is just about knowing, being able to track and know what choices to make that are going to ultimately lead to the expression of health. And, you know, and it's, I think, especially with the work that you're doing, like, and the impact of glucose on all aspects of cognitive function and neurologic health, I think all of us are trying to, you know, have more energy, have a sharper memory, have stable and elevated mood, you know, have great sleep, and to live a pain-free life. And all five of those things are impacted by glucose. So to just, even aside from preventing future disease or whatnot, to just live our most comfortable, happy, energetic, thriving, high performance life now, this is just, it's, you know, glucose is not the panacea, but it's an incredibly actionable, easy to modify biomarker that can up level all aspects of our cognitive lives. And so I think it's exciting, because sometimes it can feel helpless in the face of so many different, you know, wellness behaviors and all these different things we have to, you know, kind of track and do. But glucose is a really nice metric to orient around, because it is impacted by, you know, all the different things I think a lot of us are working on: sleep, exercise, stress management, food, diet, and so it's a nice one to really orient around.
And especially brain inflammation. I was reading this research, and I was going like way back in time. Okay, looking at insulin and blood glucose. And I found this research that was based around linoleic acid. I want to know what your take is, because it's basically summed up. They're saying that this is like at the root cause of metabolic dysfunction. And when you look at linoleic acid and what it is, it's found in a lot of plants and found in nuts, for example, and seeds and sunflower seeds. And it's like, well, okay. And this is this indicative of metabolic dysfunction? Like, how can we know what is going to be, you know, at the macronutrient level, what is going to be affecting us?
So at the macronutrient level, what is going to be affecting us? Well, so moving beyond glucose basically into like sort of other foods that we need to track for health, is that kind of...
Well, yeah, because there's this big debate right now about the carnivore diet versus the vegan diet. And I've had two people who are, you know, on the podcast who are huge in those spaces, who are really for, you know, don't eat plants, because plants contain so much linoleic acid, which is really at the root cause of metabolic dysfunction. And then you've got people on the other end of the spectrum saying, stay away from meat because it's doing X, Y, Z to the body. And, you know, and then there's just the rest of the world is basically saying, well, what do I do? You know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really good point. And I think that really it gets down to kind of one of my core tenets of healthcare, which is that food and everything that we eat is molecular information. Food is not, you know, food is pleasurable, food is enjoyable, food is a community activity, but ultimately it's molecular information. It's a signaling molecule and it's a building block. Those are the two purposes of food. And it tells our cells and genes exactly what to do and how, and it also forms the substrate through which we build new parts of the body. So that's just sort of like high level. And then you have to really think deeply about, you know, context in food as well. And so linoleic acid is an interesting one because, yes, it's found in plants. It's just, for people who are listening, it's kind of one of the high level omega-6 fatty acids. There's different types of fats, and there's omega-3s, omega-6s, omega-9s, you know, saturated fats. And linoleic acid is one of the high up on the chain of omega-6s and can get converted downstream to other types of fats, to gamma linoleic acid, to arachidonic acid, and to others. And something that can be problematic about linoleic acid is that it is easily oxidized. And so it can essentially become reactive, and that can create problems in the body, like inflammation. Reactive free radicals and oxidized molecules can be very pro-inflammatory. And this is why there's a lot of talk about we should be avoiding like processed vegetable oils, you know, safflower, sunflower oil, corn oil, soybean oil, et cetera, because they contain a lot of linoleic acid, and they basically can create quite a bit of free radical exposure in the body, and that can be problematic. So, yeah, so it's definitely, it's really interesting. And I think we're just exposed to, I mean, again, it's like these new exposures for our bodies that we like sort of were never meant to be exposed to. We, every single like processed food package that you know, pick up in the store has some type of refined oil in it, canola, safflower, sunflower, corn, whatever. So, you know, this is, it's kind of in everything. It's in salad dressings, it's in crackers, it's in breads. And so we're just getting these massive exposures. Is that the same as saying that eating some whole foods and vegetables that are packaged with thousands of phytochemicals, many of which are antioxidants and that can buffer free radicals, that that's the same as eating, you know, a ton of refined oxidized sunflower oil per day? It's totally different. It's a completely different conversation. And it's really easy, I think, to say like, oh, it's all the same, it's all linoleic acid. But that's, I don't think that's true. I think that foods packaged in their whole food form, which nature created to be packaged with a lot of things that actually buffer some of the problematic aspects of the molecular information in food, is one thing. And then the refined version that essentially just takes the harmful part and puts it in super high concentrations in the body is a totally different, is a totally different question. So I think food has to really be thought about in context. We also know that certain food compounds are going to affect people differently, you know, based on the context of their bodies, like how much, you know, saturated fat in someone who has tons and tons of inflammation versus someone who's like, you know, eating really clean sources, and has very little inflammation in their body is going to react differently. And so much of food is context dependent. So that's kind of some thoughts about that.
I think I'll be really interested in looking at, you know, before I eat, doing something like a really high intensity 5-minute or even a 10-minute workout to see if, you know, if that stabilizes my blood glucose levels before I eat, as opposed to eating the exact same thing at the exact same time and not doing any type of exercise beforehand. I've been reading a few things about that pre-meal workout and post-meal workout. Literally, it doesn't have to be big. It can be 100 push-ups, a few star jumps here and there, just to really bring up the heart rate, really stabilize blood glucose, then eat something and then do it again and see how that has an effect. This is just the experiment that I want to start trying.
Yeah, I think that's going to be fascinating to experiment with. And I think there's lots of great research to show that essentially working out for even a short period of time before and after a meal, even as little as a 20-minute walk, can have a huge impact on glucose levels. But there was some interesting research as well that showed, they took three groups and they basically said, okay, you're going to walk for, one group is going to walk for 20 minutes before each meal, three meals a day. So a total of 60 minutes, but 20 minutes before each meal, or 20 minutes after each meal, or walk for 2 minutes every 30 minutes for the entire waking day. All of that added up to 60 minutes total of walking. And the group that actually had the lowest 24-hour glucose levels was the group that walked for 2 minutes every 30 minutes throughout the day. So it really was, but all of them did better than people who didn't walk, of course. And so the bottom line is, like, do anything. Like, people should move, you know? But I thought it was interesting that, like, you know, you think about walking, it's essentially activating major muscle groups in your legs and, you know, your hamstrings, your glutes. These are huge muscles that are then contracting. And that's going to, that activity is going to make them acutely more insulin sensitive. And so doing that, you know, periodically throughout the day seems to be most advantageous. And there was, you know, research from a few years ago when standing desks were getting really hot that was talking about how, like, people who exercise once a day, like, it doesn't counteract the effects of essentially sitting at work throughout the whole day. Like, it's not, that sedentary behavior is still very damaging, even if you work out each day. So I think this kind of adds a little bit to that sort of those, that commentary that came out a few years ago, to really just say, like, the more we can move periodically, even in tiny little bits, like 2 minutes throughout the day, is extremely valuable for our metabolic health.
Yeah, I think this is going to open the doors. I think Levels Now is going to open the doors to so many different people experimenting. I know that there's, and quote me if I'm wrong, but Ceylon cinnamon has a very big factor. Like, doesn't that have something to do with as well, like with stabilizing blood glucose before you eat food? I've read something around Ceylon cinnamon, having that before you eat a meal can help with lowering blood glucose levels.
It does. It does. There's good scientific evidence to support this, that cinnamon has anti-diabetic effects, and it is thought to be a insulin sensitizer. So essentially making your cells more responsive to insulin and more efficient at moving glucose into the cells. And something that does a similar thing is vinegar. So there's been quite a bit of research showing that people who drink vinegar before meals have a lower glycemic response. I think the study
was apple cider vinegar.
Apple cider vinegar, white vinegar. I think the study I'm thinking about was white vinegar, and I think it was like, it was either 1 or 2 ounces, and, you know, you can mix it with water. And then they gave people like a big carb load. I think it was like 2 slices of white bread, and there was a statistically significant decrease in their post-meal glucose levels. So there's lots of little hacks like that, that, you know, can, that we, you know, add to your metabolic toolbox of essentially how to blunt the spike.
Well, I mean, there's so much room for research right here. Where do you see Levels? So you said Levels Now, you're going through your, people are just trialing it out, the program. And then by when, 2021, that's when you're going to officially launch?
Yeah, we're planning our launch for the end of this year. So right around the new year. Yeah.
And then where do you see it going? Do you see the whole world walking around with these little patches, and just becoming more metabolically fit?
You know, I really do. Our early market is really the performance optimizers, the pro sports, the pro athletes, the biohackers. You know, these are the people who are often the early adopters for this type of technology. But this is technology that we want to positively impact really every single person in the country. Metabolic health is something that really everyone needs to think about. There was a study from UNC about a year or two ago that showed that 88% of Americans are metabolically unhealthy. So only 12% of people are metabolically healthy. So this is something we really all need to be thinking about. And so what's so neat about, I think, our product and Levels is that fundamentally this is a behavior change software. This is about inspiring people with their personal data to make better choices and making it really like painless to understand what works and then move the needle on kind of moving in the right direction and build really comprehensive metabolic awareness about how to keep that glucose line flat and stable. And we know when that glucose line is flat and stable, that outcomes are much better for all aspects of health. And so, you know, I think in time, we know, you know, we all know like, oh, you should walk 10,000 steps a day and you should get 8 hours of sleep. And I think people will be talking about it, glucose like that, saying like, well, yeah, we all know that we need to keep our glucose lines like flat and stable. And it will be similar in that regard to those other trackers. And so we're really hoping to, big picture, reverse the trend of metabolic dysfunction, that we have a really robust research effort going on right now to show clinical validity of our product. We're working with a number of different academic institutions and also industry partners in industry to show that, to essentially show in peer-reviewed scientific literature that what we've seen in our early beta customers, which is vast improvements rapidly of metabolic metrics, that this can be done at scale. And then what's exciting is that there's a lot of hardware companies that are essentially making new versions of CGMs. And right now there's three companies that make CGMs and many more are coming down the pipeline. And there are also people working on multi-analyte markers that can look at other markers in real time. And so we're seeing some really exciting movement in the hardware space. And as that can then be integrated also into this type of behavior change software, we're going to just see more and more exciting stuff happening. And I think that'll also drive the prices down because there's going to be more players in the market on the hardware side. So lots of exciting stuff to come, but really our North Star is to make a meaningful dent in the metabolic health crisis and move that number from 88% down to ideally zero. So,
well, you've already got your foot in the door and a seat at the table. I'm so excited to see what the future holds for Levels. And thank you so much for coming on the podcast and really explaining to everybody what metabolic health is and everything about blood glucose. I've had a lot of fun with you. What I'll do is I'm going to link absolutely everything, where to find you, where to find Levels, everything we've spoken about in the show notes of this episode. So Dr. Casey, thank you so much for being part of the Neuro Experience podcast.
Thank you.